Hallo und herzlich willkommen. Hello and welcome to a new episode of History and Politics, the Körber Stiftung's podcast on history and politics, this time again in English. My name is Gabriele Wojdelko, and as always, this episode deals with the question why and how history shapes the present. But hold on for a second. Today, it's slightly different and really special because we are facing a friendly takeover. I'd like to warmly welcome Katja Heuer and Oliver Moody, who are hosting our new four-part special summer series, The New Germany. Germany after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, after the German Chancellor's proclamation of a Zeitenwende, the dawn of a new era. All the while keeping an eye on history, of course, as you are used to it from our podcast. Welcome, Katja and Oliver. Over to you, and now let's get started.
Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of The New Germany, a special four-part series from the History and Politics podcast of the Körber Stiftung, presented in English for the very first time. In new episodes every 2 weeks, we'll explore the big questions that the war in Ukraine is asking of Germany. Will it need to become a major military power again? Why is its biggest embassy still in Moscow? How can it find solutions to its ravenous energy needs? And will the ghosts of Germany's past ever stop haunting its present?
With the country at the crossroads of history, what can a look in the rearview mirror tell us about the paths that lie ahead? Chancellor Olaf Scholz spoke of the Russian invasion of Ukraine as a Zeitenwende, a turning point. But will and can he change the course of German history?
I'm Oliver Moody, a British journalist based in Berlin, and I'll be your driver for today. Join us in our trusty Trabant. You might want to bring a spare necktie in case the fan belt breaks. As we set off on our journey into Germany's past and future, the ride may be a little bumpy, as we won't be able to avoid some of the more uncomfortable potholes in the national story.
Oh, don't tailgate, Oliver. You're frightening Olaf Scholz, whose Kanzler Mercedes is cruising at a sensible speed right ahead of us. I'm Katja Heuer, a German historian based in Britain, and I'll be your helpful backseat driver on this trip. With the roadmap of history firmly planted on my lap, I will make sure Oliver doesn't get us lost in the badly signposted side roads of the present.
Well, even with your map reading abilities, we ought to be able to find our destination because we are firmly headed eastbound. In this episode of the New Germany podcast, we are going to explore Germany's long and tumultuous relationship with Russia. The largest country in the world has always held a special place in the German imagination and in German foreign policy. The Russo-German connection is it's a bit of a love-hate relationship, isn't it, Katja?
Yeah, I think you can certainly say that again. There's been plenty of love and plenty of hate, too, in the relationship between those two European giants. It's remarkable, really, how much this relationship has always been shaped by emotionality rather than rational calculation. If I wasn't a respectable historian, I'd be tempted to describe Russia and Germany as the Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton of European states. They just can't seem to let go of one another, even when each is tied up in allegiances elsewhere, and even when the relationship isn't always exactly a happy one.
Which one's Richard Burton?
That is a very good question. Let's see if we can try and work that out during the course of this episode.
I mean, one thing you can absolutely generalise about the history of German-Russian relations is that very often it has been personal ties between the people right at the top and personal ties between some real Burton and Taylor figures, from Catherine the Great and Napoleon to Bismarck, Lenin and Hitler. Russia's leader in the here and now still seems obsessed with many of these characters, looking for qualities to be admired or abhorred. In one of his recent speeches, Putin even compared himself to Peter the Great, whose reign ended 300 years ago. Katya, if we've got to go that far back to understand the Russo-German entanglement, can you please give us a whistle-stop tour before we come back to the more familiar terrain of the 20th and 21st centuries?
Well, where shall I start? In the Middle Ages, many German settlers begin to...
Katya, I understand that you historians think everything is too complex to sum up, but let's set you a challenge, because we are in a tight time frame here. We've got a lot to get through. I am going to give you a maximum of 150 seconds to explain to our listeners what happened between Germany and Russia before 1914. That's 1 second for each year from the end of Peter the Great's Northern War with Sweden to the unification of Germany, taking in Peter, Catherine, Napoleon, Bismarck and Lenin. And your time starts now?
Well, Peter the Great, who we've just heard Putin is very obsessed with, ruled the country from 1682 to 1725. And in that time, he founded St. Petersburg. And in order to come up with some nice new buildings and a lovely structure for it, he invited a lot of German architects and engineers and other people like that over, so that many members of the German middle classes basically would bring their influence, their Western influence, to Russia. His grandson, in turn, who was Peter III, was German-born himself and was also married to another German, Catherine, who would later become Catherine the Great. They briefly ran Russia together in 1762, before Catherine overthrew him and ruled in her own right. Strangely enough, even though she was German, she was also a Russian nationalist and set out to make Russia great again, as it were, and invited another batch of Germans over, particularly into the Volga region, where they were supposed to bring their Western culture and influence into Russia, modernize it, liberalize it, and basically make it a more Western-orientated country. Skipping forward to Napoleon, who famously marched into Russia in 1812, and that didn't quite work out, which then encouraged Prussia to join forces with Russia against Napoleon and start fighting with them. This brought the two armies very closely together, and they fought together for those years of the so-called liberation wars. And the Prussian military was so impressed with some of the Russian military traditions that they took some of them over, most famously the Große Zapfenstreich, the Great Military Tattoo, which the German army still uses today. Skipping forward again to Otto von Bismarck, who founded Germany in 1871, he was obsessed with Russia too, and said famously that the secret to good foreign policy is a good treaty with Russia. Skipping forward again to the First World War, Germany and Russia are at war with one another, despite the fact that Wilhelm II, the German Kaiser, thought that he could convince his cousin, Tsar Nicholas II, on the Russian throne, that they should not go to war with one another. But of course, that didn't work out. Germany tries everything it can to end the war on the Eastern Front as quickly as possible, including smuggling a well-known person called Lenin back into Russia, which caused a lot of upheaval there. Russia loses the war, and that's where we are at the end of the First World War. Done.
168 seconds, Katya. It's not good enough. How painful was that?
It is very complex, though. That was very painful. I mean, I should probably wear a horsehair shirt for a while until the goddess of history is appeased again. Maybe she hasn't noticed quite yet, so if we move on very quickly, we might get away with it. Why do you think the two world wars, both of which were most savagely fought on the Eastern Front, didn't sever the link between Germany and Russia for good?
Well, as Mrs. Potts sang at the end of Beauty and the Beast, it's really a tale as old as time. The Germans needed raw materials and a market for their finished products, and the Russians needed German industrial expertise, especially at the end of the First World War. They're also two quite diplomatically isolated countries that needed friends. So in 1922, Germany was one of the first states to bring Russia back into the fold with the Treaty of Rapallo, which included secret clauses allowing the Germans to rearm by training their pilots at Lipetsk and to build tanks near Moscow and Rostov-on-Don. There's also something, I think, to be said here about the cultural side of the special relationship. The ethnic German settlers in Russia had an enormous influence on everything from the structure of the Russian military to the Russian language itself. The Russian word for mine, Schachter, comes from the German Schacht. And as Stalin famously said after the end of the Second World War, the Hitlers come and go, but the German people and the German state remain. And even a few months ago, you'd still quite often hear in private conversations with a certain stripe of older German official that Germany had never really been a country of the West in the way that France or Britain were, that it had always looked at least just as much to the East.
Yes, but those boundaries were already to blur, weren't they, straight away after the Second World War. As you say, Germany, despite having just fought the East and the West, is now looking in both of those directions again for partnerships. And the occupation and division of Germany meant that the two German states that emerged from it were looking East and West respectively. So you effectively ended up, as we discussed in our previous episode, with West Germany joining NATO in 1955 and therefore firmly aligning itself with the West. The West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer was particularly keen that that would happen, even if it was at the expense of a potential reunification of the two Germanies. And as a result of that, East Germany also started to align itself with a bigger partner, as it were, with Russia, and joins the Warsaw Pact with its newly formed National People's Army. And so very quickly you end up with the two Germanies having very different relationships with Russia, one seeing it as an enemy, the other as a friend and partner.
But that distinction didn't stay hard and fast for that long. Because even under the anti-communist government of Konrad Adenauer, West Germany's first chancellor, there were tentative overtures towards the makings of a kind of reconciliation. Things like the release of tens of thousands of Wehrmacht prisoners of war from Russian camps. And things really began to shift at the end of the 60s under Willy Brandt, the first social democratic chancellor, who famously pursued a policy of détente known as Ostpolitik, which is basically acknowledging that Germany's divided and that giving up on reclaiming the territories east of the border with Poland, building a personal relationship with Brezhnev, the Soviet leader, and trying to find common ground where Bonn and Moscow could cooperate, such as natural gas pipelines or commemorating the victims of Nazi German atrocities.
Yeah, in the East, it isn't quite as straightforward as it sounds either. East Germany or the GDR is often seen as a sort of Soviet satellite state, even a kind of, you know, Russified state, but it wasn't really. There was a lot of tension as well between the East German authorities and Moscow. This became worse and worse, really, as time passed on, because the GDR was really looking towards West Germany for a lot of its economic cooperation. It made sense for those two states to exchange different products that could be produced on either side and to sort of, you know, form economic ties, which in turn made the Soviet Union rather suspicious that some sort of, you know, inner German collusion was afoot again. And this became particularly apparent in the kind of wake of the oil crises, when Russia basically ended up selling oil much more lucratively to West Germany than it could to East Germany under favorable conditions. And so it, you know, sort of stopped supplying them with the amount of economic aid that they needed. And worse, even when in 1985, Gorbachev came into power in the Soviet Union, and that relationship began to shift completely because he was pushing for reforms and the GDR's more conservative politicians were trying to hold on to the old socialist ways effectively, and the relationship began really to break in the late 1980s.
Yeah, and then the Berlin Wall falls in 1989. In 1990, the two Germanys leap joyously back into each other's arms. The Cold War comes to an end, and everyone basically thinks this is the end of the era of Russo-German animosity, at least in Germany. In the 1990s, there's a very strong sense shared, among others, by a certain long-haired leftist firebrand called Olaf Scholz, that Moscow had given the Germans the gift of reunification, in large part because of the success of the SPD's Ostpolitik. And in return, there's this idea that because of its crimes on the Eastern Front, Germany owes it to Russia to use its painful experience of coming out of a totalitarian dictatorship and binding itself back into the civilized European order through ties of politics and commerce. And there are two really important German concepts to understand here. And the first one is Wandel durch Handel, literally change through trade. This is the notion that just building up economic interdependence spreads a kind of benevolent political influence and modernizes your partner country. And the second, which gets a bit overlooked, but which I think is really significant for understanding where we've got to today, is Annäherung durch Verflechtung, rapprochement through entanglement, which basically meant getting the entire spectrum of the German and Russian elites, that's politicians, scientists, religious leaders, business leaders, even artists, to hang out together in the hope that Russia's ruling classes would somehow fall under the spell of Western liberal democratic values. But you could argue, and I would, that precisely the opposite happened in the end. And what you actually wind up with is a generation of people at the top of the German establishment who have a sense of personal involvement with Russia, a sense of personal duty towards Russia, and a heightened sensitivity to Putin's lines of argument. And one more thing I'd want to chip in very quickly is that I think this idea of a great power special relationship between Germany and Russia has been quite flattering to a certain kind of German politician, because it gives them a theatre to act in, a stage on which Berlin still feels like a really serious geopolitical heavyweight and almost a kind of regional hegemon.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And the two politicians that are mostly associated with that are the sort of two previous chancellors before Kohl, Angela Merkel and Gerhard Schröder. But it's often forgotten that Helmut Kohl, who was Angela Merkel's mentor and Gerhard Schröder's predecessor as German chancellor, the unification chancellor, too placed a very high value on good relations with Moscow. He once said that, and again I quote here, Russia was Germany's most important neighbor in the East and will remain so. And that, I think, that, you know, turn of phrase, most important neighbor, there isn't a direct border between Germany and Russia anymore. And yet, politically and ideologically, it often feels as though there was. And this is something that really frightens and bothers and concerns a lot of the Eastern European nations who are kind of wedged between Germany and Russia. And as they forge closer and closer relationships with one another, even today, there's often a tendency to forget or to overlook the concerns of the states that lie in between. And this is something that goes back a long way. I told you Catherine the Great would be relevant because the partition of Poland, effectively, you know, she did that. You ended up basically with the partition of Poland, you know, organized between the German states on the one side and Russia on the other. And there's a long history of that. Perhaps the more famous and more recent example is the Hitler-Stalin Pact, which involved a secret part in which Poland was to be split between the two of them, and then both of them invaded, you know, in a coordinated fashion and split the country between them. And for somebody like Helmut Kohl to sit there and talk of Russia as a neighbor, you know, sort of ignores the concerns in between. So I think perhaps it's no wonder that the Eastern European states today are still somewhat wary of collusion between Moscow and Berlin.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good point about the partition of Poland. And the idea that you could form, if you listen to some Eastern European capitals, is that this war in Ukraine is just an inconvenience to Germany. It just wants to be rid of it. It wants to go back to business as normal. It doesn't really feel like it's existential in the same way that the Eastern Europeans do. And they watched in 2015, Germany and France sit down at the negotiating table with Russia and Ukraine after the annexation of Crimea and thrash out basically a sort of very flimsy ceasefire arrangement called the Minsk Accords. We could do a whole episode on those. I won't go into the detail, but essentially the worry now is precisely that we're going to wind up with Minsk II, that Macron and Scholz are going to come in and essentially twist the Ukrainians' arms effectively into agreeing to some kind of disadvantageous peace deal. Scholz has been, to his credit, very clear that that's not what he wants. He says Ukraine must decide. But also, because he has not been very explicit about what he does want from this war, there has been a certain space that he's left in which those kind of doubts can fester. And it probably did help that recent German chancellors cultivated personal connections to Putin that have been somewhat warmer than his interactions with other Central European leaders.
Warmer. Very good, very good. I can see where this is going. Go on then. You've been gearing up for this entire episode to tell us about the sauna.
It's the only reason I agreed to do an episode on Russia. When Putin first came to power at the turn of the millennium, the German Chancellor of the day, Gerhard Schröder, was very quick to try and establish a friendship that went beyond any kind of political shared interests. So they used to take off all their clothes, grab a beer, and sweat it out in Putin's Banya sauna, which was apparently heated to 100 degrees Celsius, which is just the fabric of my darkest nightmares, being stuck on a sweaty wooden bench with Putin. But for Schröder, it was the beginning of a true bromance. Putin used to have Schröder and his successive wives round for sledging at Christmas. He helped Schröder to adopt a couple of little Russian children. And then after Schröder got voted out of office, Putin recompensed him with a number of very lucrative sinecures on the boards of Russian companies, including the state-owned energy giants Gazprom and Rosneft.
Yeah, I don't think Angela Merkel had any intentions of matching that level of intimacy with the Russian leader.
She liked disorder.
Yeah, I'm not sure next to Vladimir Putin, but yeah, let's not go there, I would say. She too certainly felt that she had a closer connection to Putin than many other Western leaders. You do end up with a lot of situations where there's trouble in Eastern Europe, like last year, for instance, when there was the sort of build-up of refugees on the Belarusian-Polish border. And instead of sorting this out with the countries involved, Angela Merkel picked up the phone and called Putin to try and talk about this and see if a solution could be found. It probably helps that they don't have communication problems. So Merkel learned Russian at school and was very good at it. Putin speaks fluent German. They were both in East Germany when the Berlin Wall fell, which Putin sort of witnessed as a KGB officer stationed in Dresden, and Merkel was from East Germany. So there are a fair amount of personal ties between the two of them as well. But I think Schröder and Merkel could not have been any more wrong. Neither really understood Putin, in my view, and his ambitions for Russia. Have they reflected on this since?
Well, with Merkel, I think it's quite a nuanced picture. So she kept a very low profile for the first couple of months of the war. And then she came out a few weeks ago and did her first big interview since leaving office. And what she said is that she was never under any kind of illusion about the sort of man she was dealing with in the Kremlin. And it was precisely because she knew what Putin was capable of. For example, that she blocked Ukraine and Georgia's path to NATO accession in 2008 to remove a potential provocation that could have led to a seriously escalating conflict. And I think, on the face of it, that's kind of puzzling, because she was very suspicious of Putin, but she carried on building bridges with him. So how do you square that circle? And the best way of doing that, I've heard, is from my excellent British colleague, Jeremy Cliff, who has written about Merkel's very deterministic understanding of history, which is basically that peace and democracy are incredibly fragile, far more fragile than people think, and they're constantly threatening to tip over into conflict and authoritarianism. But, crucially, there's only so much that individual leaders and countries can do about this. So the best you can hope for is to try and just work with the currents and limit the damage. And Schröder's case is much more straightforward. He's criticised the war in Ukraine in extremely vague terms. But apart from that, I think you can fairly say there hasn't been an iota of self-criticism or indeed criticism of Putin. In fact, he's argued pretty consistently for trying to reach an accommodation with Russia and fixing the broken ties. But at least Scholz sees things clearly now, right? He'd only been in office for a couple of months when the invasion happened. Do you think the Zeitenwende involves a changing relationship with Russia?
I think it might do in economic terms, not least because Scholz's coalition partners, the Green Party, seem a lot more hawkish on Russia and certainly from an environmental point of view alone want to, you know, limit the amount of fossil fuels coming from Russia. So I think there's a reset going on there with the LNG terminals being built now. So there's going to be gas coming from elsewhere, which we'll also address in the next episode. But this automatically, I think, will mean that there is less of a kind of substantial economic relationship between the two countries. But I don't see the two letting go of that relationship, given the long, long history of it. I don't see how, you know, if the two world wars weren't a break, Ukraine isn't going to do that, I don't think.
Yeah, I buy most of that. I think I'm probably about 25% more optimistic than you are, purely because the ideas that have underpinned the modern German-Russian relationship, the Wandel durch Handel, the Annäherung durch Verflechtung, have been pretty badly discredited. And I mean, if there's one thing that you learn by studying the history of this relationship, it's never say that it's going to be like this forever. But I certainly feel that those ideas are not coming back in the near future. And the gas dependency too is on the way out. Maybe it'll come back one day. But if you look at the kind of climate policies and the energy strategy of the German government, it's pretty clear that that's also going to be out of the game for a while. And there's one really interesting aspect to this, right? Which is that Scholz's party, the Social Democrats, have had as one of their fundamental foreign policy maxims for a long time that you can't have peace in Europe against Russia, only with Russia. And this was so kind of baked into their thinking that Scholz actually said exactly those words after he met Putin a few days before the invasion. And now the party is talking about scrapping that line from its fundamental statement of values. But there's a catch here, right? Like, what do you replace it with? And there's been a certain tendency from Scholz and other leading social democrats to push back against the idea that they need to critically interrogate their own history before they can move on and come up with a new set of Russia policies. Encouragingly, though, Lars Klingbeil, one of the leaders of the party, did give a foreign policy speech recently where he talked about precisely going back over Ostpolitik and taking out the parts that were effective and leaving out the parts that weren't. So I feel like German politics is evolving on this piece. But as you say, it's been such a roller coaster over the past few centuries that we could be anywhere in 10 years' time.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to hope that that's a generational thing. But what worried me is that when Klingbeil gave the speech about changing and kind of building a bigger German army and finding a new role for Germany in the world, he was most heavily criticized from the young socialists, from the youth wing on this. And so I feel that there's still a great deal of idealism, pacifism, over-optimistic attitudes going on there that make me think perhaps there's a swing backwards again after this. But we'll see.
Talking of over-optimistic attitudes, I am hoping that our distinguished guest can clear up all of the unresolved issues that have arisen in this discussion.
Germany has repeatedly tried and often failed to make Russia a partner of its European strategy. But what does Germany mean to Russia in turn? And what are the implications of all of this for the relationship between the two countries going forward? We are delighted to have a guest on today who is in a good place to answer these important questions. Sergei Rachenko is a Russian-born historian and political commentator. He is the Wilson E. Schmidt, a distinguished professor at the Henry A. Kissinger Center for Global Affairs of the John Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a visiting professor at Cardiff University. Dobry den, Sergei. We are delighted to have you on the New Germany podcast today.
Thank you for having me on.
Sergei, you were born in Russia, but have lived in various Western countries for a long time. What went through your mind when you woke up on the morning of February the 24th and saw that Putin had invaded Ukraine?
So I had a feeling of despair. I was depressed, really badly depressed for a week. And it was for a variety of reasons. For a start, I have Ukrainian roots, although I was born in Russia. Mainly, you know, generally speaking, all of my grandparents certainly were Ukrainian. So I'm a mixed case, you know, I'm a Russo-Ukrainian, as many Russians, of course, are. And so this whole idea that Russia would invade Ukraine and bomb its cities and, you know, kill innocent people, it was just so difficult to take. So that was one reason for being depressed. And the other reason is that I was in a sense of self-denial. I mean, we had the intelligence for weeks and months leading up to the invasion. And people were talking about, you know, the U.S. intelligence made the case that Putin has decided to invade. But it was so difficult to accept this. Mentally, it was difficult to accept that something like this could even possibly happen in our day and age. I was in Kiev and Moscow in the days and weeks prior to the invasion, speaking to colleagues there in the policy community, and so few people on either side actually saw it coming. The Ukrainians thought it was some kind of a strategic ploy by Putin to have put greater pressure, I guess, on Kiev. And the Russian policy community were also saying the same thing. They were like, well, it doesn't make any sense. Who would do something like this? So for all those reasons, you know, it came as a shock. And yes, it took quite a few days for me to get over this, as it were, at the mental level before I started to really bring different parts of this picture together and just, you know, start to ask myself questions. Well, where do we go from here?
Well, it seems to have caused significantly less distress to some elements of the German populations. There have been surveys that basically showed that there is some sympathy in Germany for the idea that Putin was provoked by the West. And these people are often described as Putin-Versteher, so those who understand Putin. To what extent do you think are Germans in a better position to understand Russia compared to other Western nations?
Sure. Well, I'm not German, so it's difficult for me to judge. But here, I'll venture a possible answer to this. So I think we would have to start with this narrative of victimhood that we have in Russia. Yeah, the Russians have this idea or this narrative that Russia has always been invaded by Western countries. It is always under threat from the West, etc., etc. And of course, the most important part of that narrative is the experience of the Second World War, Germany's invasion of what was then the Soviet Union in June 1941, which has still considerable relevance to Russians even today, even though, of course, the veterans of the conflict are, by and large, they have passed from the scene. And yet, it is still very important. It constitutes a major part of this government, but not only government narrative. I think it's a general public narrative about, you know, part of Russian victimhood or perception of self-perception of victimhood. And if you look at it from the German perspective, I suppose, you know, of course, there's the German narrative as well. And that is the narrative of guilt that Germany did invade countries in the Second World War, not least the Soviet Union, not least Russia. And so there's some sort of some space where these two narratives overlap, as in the Russians are saying, well, the West has always invaded us, and look at what the Germans have done. And the Germans say, well, you know, yeah, we did invade the Soviet Union in 1941, therefore, we can understand why they feel this way. Now, so that is just a guess. You know, I don't know. You know, I have probably better insights in the Russian thinking about this than the German thinking. But I guess I would imagine some Germans think that Russian complaints about it being under pressure from the West are not altogether irrelevant.
There's a fairly long history behind this idea that Germany can bring about change in the world through soft power rather than military power. It was more than 50 years ago that the Social Democrat Chancellor Willy Brandt's Ostpolitik began the process of normalizing relations with Soviet Russia. Can you tell us a little bit about how Brandt's overtures were received in Moscow? And is the collapse of the Soviet Union proof that it worked, as some in Germany have claimed?
Sure, this is a very, very interesting story. The process of Ostpolitik, you know, a lot of people think that Brandt began it, but actually there was a kind of Ostpolitik already happening in the mid-1960s with the Soviet engagement with the French. So it was the French president, Charles de Gaulle, who really was reaching out to the Soviet Union, seeking some sort of a different relationship with Moscow than the general relationship between the West and the Soviet Union at the time. And the Soviet leaders, for their part, really embraced de Gaulle. They thought that he was an important partner in Europe. They thought that the fact that France exited a military structure of NATO in 1966 really played into the Soviet strategy, because they've always wanted to undermine NATO. So they built up this relationship with de Gaulle. But then, of course, Brandt came onto the scene with his victory in the West German elections in 1969, and he then pursued this policy of Ostpolitik, or improving of relations with Moscow. Now, if you think about the Soviet side of this, what was happening in the Soviet Union at that time, two things come to mind. First of all, in 1968, the Soviet Union brutally suppressed the Prague Spring by invading Czechoslovakia. And the effect of this was interesting in the sense, at one level, the Soviet Union, at one level, of course, it was a very, terrible invasion. At another level, there was very little Western reaction to this, actually. So the Soviets kind of asserted their sphere of influence, or their control of their sphere of influence. And there was an understanding that perhaps you can build some sort of a peaceful coexistence, peaceful relationship based on that recognition. So you could argue, as some historians have, for example, Vlad Zubok has argued that the 1968 in the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia actually became a sort of a turning point for East-West relationship, paving way later to Helsinki, to the final act, to detente, broadly speaking. So this is one part of the equation. The other, of course, is you have to remember what the Soviets were dealing with in the East at that time. Their relationship with China had been going downhill since the late 1950s. By the late 1960s, it really deteriorated to a considerable degree. In 1966, the Chinese launched the Cultural Revolution, which had anti-Soviet kind of underpinning. And then there were border clashes as well. In 1969, the Russians and the Chinese were actually fighting an undeclared border war in the Far East, a place called Zhenbaodao or Damansky Island in Russian. And then the Russians actually threatened hinted at the possibility of a preemptive nuclear strike against China. Brezhnev, the Soviet leader, was absolutely terrified of the prospect of China invading the Soviet Union. He really was worried about China. And in that context, improving relations with the West, achieving some form of detente, became very desirable for him. There were economic reasons, there were political reasons. So when Brandt reached out, he, of course, embraced Brandt. They had very interesting relationship that developed between them. They met, for example, in Crimea and really kind of struck a friendship, if you could call it this way, leading, of course, to the signing of the Moscow Treaty in 1970 and the blossoming of European detente, which then overlapped with another thing, in Soviet-American relations, which was the Soviet-American detente that began already at that time, but really was given a boost with Nixon's visit to Moscow in May 1972.
And in skipping forward a few decades, in more recent German-Russo relations, the kind of economic connection between the two countries intensified even more between Gerhard Schröder and Angela Merkel. Basically, they set up a system that meant that Russia is now one of Germany's biggest trading partners alongside China. But was this idea that German economic ties to Russia kind of deterred Russia from disturbing the peace in Europe ever valid, or did that money simply help to fund Putin's war machine?
Well, sure, it's not a new idea. I mean, we have known about this idea for decades and decades and decades. And indeed, there was an idea before the outbreak of the First World War that the world was so connected economically that certainly, a war would not break out. And then what happened? A major war broke out. So this doesn't mean that economic interdependence does not prevent war. It does contribute to the calculations of costs and benefits. In other words, clearly, if you have a close economic relationship, you'll have to think twice whether you want to undermine that by resorting to force. So I think it's probably the same for Russian-German. I mean, Soviet-German and Russian-German relations. Germany was an important partner for the Soviet Union in economic terms. So was France, as a matter of fact, during the 1970s. At that time, the Soviet Union was still engaged in the construction of socialism and export of communism, and was occupying much of Eastern Europe, etc. Does it mean that you could not engage with it economically? Well, it's an interesting question. If you go then fast forward to our own days, we have had Russia that was very authoritarian, increasingly authoritarian, with Putin unleashing repressive measures against his domestic opponents. And yet there was this economic relationship with Western Europe, including, of course, with Germany. But the question is, well, so what should we have woken up to this earlier and said, oh, look, the Russians are actually, they're repressive and they're aggressive. So therefore, we should apply economic sanctions against them. It's an interesting question, and there are different ways of answering this. Yeah, some people will say, well, we should have woken up in 2014. We should have seen what the Russians were doing in Crimea and applied more extensive sanctions against them. And there's some truth to this point of view, but you know, has this relationship, has this economic relationship that Russia and Germany has fostered, has it prevented Putin's aggression against Ukraine? Well, the obvious answer, it hasn't. Does it mean that, you know, sanctions should have been applied much earlier? I don't know. That's a difficult question for me.
Sergey, you mentioned the personal friendship that emerged between Brezhnev and Brandt. Pretty much from the moment Putin first came to power, successive German chancellors tried to strike up a similarly personal relationship with him, bearing in mind that he speaks excellent German as a result of his time as a KGB officer in Dresden, and that Germany is to a certain extent almost his intellectual gateway into Western Europe. So famously, Gerhard Schröder formed a warm personal friendship. They used to spend Christmas together. They'd go for these long, boozy sauna sessions. Angela Merkel was a bit more standoffish, but very frequently telephoned him directly to discuss problems in Eastern Europe, even late into 2021. And most recently, Olaf Scholz visited Putin in Moscow shortly before the start of the war. And since the invasion, he has been on the telephone with Putin several times. So do you think German leaders do or did have what you might call a special relationship with Putin's Kremlin?
I think it goes beyond leaders. Clearly, Germany for Russia is a key partner in Europe. And they always thought of Germany as the key partner in Europe. Yeah, and this is not something that Putin had invented. Even, you know, Stalin had thought that way. Brezhnev certainly thought that way. For him, that relationship with Brandt was not just, you know, important in personal terms, but he understood that Germany was the major power on the European continent. Therefore, you had to kind of build up a relationship with them. Also, the Russians and the Soviets before them have had this idea that you could somehow, that the Germans were always upset with their position in Europe. Therefore, you could somehow subvert them a little bit and bring them over to your side because they also want to play or have a greater independence from their transatlantic partners and so on and so forth. Moscow's long-term policy towards Germany has been to play Germany against France and France against Germany, and also play both of them against the United States. That's kind of, I think it really is unchanged since the times of Brezhnev in this regard. Having a good personal relationship clearly matters for building up sort of state-to-state relations. And Brezhnev and Brandt are case in point here. It's interesting, for example, that Brezhnev absolutely hated Chairman Mao Zedong of China. He hated him. He thought that Mao Zedong was unreliable, untrustworthy, like, you know, very hideous personality, and so on and so forth. And did that contribute to his very, you know, highly, his suspicions of China, his mistrust of China? Well, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That explains much of it as well. And so he was able to speak to Brandt. And this is, by the way, you know, we're speaking here about Brezhnev, who actually was involved in the Second World War, not in a major capacity, but, you know, the Soviet leaders were, until, I suppose, Gorbachev was the only one who, well, even Gorbachev experienced the Second World War as a teenager, as it were. But, you know, the Soviet leaders before Gorbachev had a direct experience of the Second World War, and Brezhnev had a direct experience in this regard with Germany, but he was able to overcome this. You know, he did not have any kind of personal bitterness or anything like that on this account, and he built up a relationship of trust with Brandt, which clearly helped direct Soviet-West German relations in the needed direction as far as the Soviet Union was concerned. And I think Putin is also in the same kind of position. So he obviously had extensive experience of East Germany, having served in Dresden as a KGB officer, you know, clearly has friends in Germany, including speaks German, and thought that he could build on that background, on that relationship, to forge special relations with people like Schröder, which he did, of course, and even with Angela Merkel, which, you know, I was always puzzled by their relationship, because, you know, some people say that they actually were, you know, they talked a lot, et cetera, but then you had this bizarre episodes where Putin was trying to scare Merkel with his dog, et cetera, you know, and you think, you know, what's going on there? This is really strange. Has it, you know, so what has it done to Russia-German relations? Clearly, this kind of relationships at the leadership level have helped But okay, so he obviously also have not prevented Putin from going off the rails and invading Ukraine, as Scholz discovered when he went to Moscow, you know, was trying to make a case. And then Putin said, okay, well, you know, never mind. But there's a genocide going on in eastern Ukraine. Therefore, we'll invade anyway. So there are limits to this friendship.
But given these personal friendships and also the fact that, you know, as you say, that the two take each other sort of seriously as kind of major powers in Europe, are the Eastern European states that are wedged between those two right to doubt Germany's commitment to their defense against Russian ambitions in the region?
Well, the Eastern Europeans always suspect the Germans and the Russians because they think that they have some, you know, that the memories, historical memories are so strong in this regard. So for the Polish, the key defining national experience has been the division of Poland between Hitler and Stalin in 1939. And they can never really overcome this. So they always, you know, there's this thing. It's like what the Russians have about this fear of being invaded or something by the West. And you could say the same thing. In Poland, there's this fear that somebody, you know, those two powers will somehow deal behind Poland's back with one another and perhaps achieve some kind of agreement at Poland's expense. And that also extends especially to the Baltics, which had, you know, had experienced brutal Soviet occupation since 1940 and only were obviously, you know, freed from this in when the Soviet Union collapsed. And for them, yeah, it's you cannot blame them for being suspicious about the Russians. I mean, if you look at not just Russia, but also the Soviet Union, you had the Soviet invasion of Hungary in 1956, you had the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, you had the near invasion, although we can argue whether or not the Soviets really intended to invade of Poland following Solidarity in 1981. And then, you know, so yeah, you have this kind of historical experience where the Eastern Europeans keep saying, look, you know, we tell you, though, our neighbors to the east, i.e. the Russians, they are dangerous, they're imperialists, and we have to keep that in mind. And they're the first to point out that, look, the Germans, you know, they're also unreliable because et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there it goes. So are they right? Well, they have a historical reason to complain about these matters. And of course, Putin's invasion of Ukraine, in retrospect, justified many of their fears and many of their accusations directed at Russia. You know, I was reading records of conversation between Lech Walesa and Bill Clinton, going back to 1993. This is the time when, you know, NATO enlargement was being discussed. And Walesa was telling Clinton, you know, we have to act now because we'll lose the chance. Now's the chance to do it, i.e. enlarge NATO, because the Russians, because as he said, it was at the time that this hideous nationalist Zhirinovsky was being elected. Came to power. Oh, he never came to power, but he scored a large number of votes in the Duma. And Walesa was saying about Zhirinovsky, every second Russian thinks like Zhirinovsky. And I thought, you know, at the time when I first was reading those transcripts, I think, oh God, this is such an exaggeration. You know, every second Russian does not think like Zhirinovsky. But then after the invasion of Ukraine, you think, well, you know, maybe Walesa was right after all. So can you blame them? No, I cannot personally blame them. I think sometimes their fear of Russia, and particularly of their fear of Russian dealings with Germany, et cetera, et cetera, I think it is a little bit counterproductive. And we're witnessing this period now as well, when there are, you know, some efforts directed at peaceful resolution of this crisis that are kind of promoted by Germany and by France as well. And the Eastern Europeans are trying to basically subvert that and torpedo this before even any kind of discussion. You can understand it. I mean, you can understand why they think this way. And you still don't know whether this is the right thing.
And very briefly, just to pick up that last point you made, what role would you like to see Germany take in the conflict? Is there anything to be said for Germany and France holding back a little bit more, just in case they could step in as intermediaries as they did in 2014?
Well, Germany and France have their interest, and they are aligned with, generally aligned, I suppose, with the interests of European Union, of the European Union as a whole. And we saw that alignment come to the fore very clearly when there was this very sharp reaction in the wake of Putin's invasion of Ukraine, where there was great European solidarity, and even the Germans and the French stood together and said, there's got to be an end to this. We're not going to yield to Putin's aggression. And they have promised to supply arms, and the French have been supplying arms. At the same time, when you go, especially as the conflict drags on, and you look at the different nuances of this, you'll see that there are differences, of course, in the way that the Germans approach the conflict and the French approach the conflict. For them, it's something further removed than, for example, for the Eastern Europeans, never mind the Ukrainians, of course, where all of these things are happening. So I would not say, it doesn't mean that they are ready to sell out the Ukrainians or override the objections of the Eastern Europeans. But it's more a case that they are perhaps more prepared to deal with Putin on a pragmatic basis. They are at the moment in a wait and see position. That is to say, at the moment, I think everybody in Berlin, much as in Paris, understands that Kyiv must be supported, including with a supply of weapons. That's the key aspect of this. And so weapons are being supplied. But depending on how this conflict then develops over the coming weeks, I think both Berlin and Paris will have to look again at their positions and see what their what their interests actually are. For example, if the Russians continue to make gains, that's one possibility. If the Russians stall, that's another possibility. If the Russians are rolled back, that's yet another possibility. And you will have to adopt your own positions depending on how the conflict unfolds. Irrespective of all of the scenarios, I think it's probably going to be in the interests of Berlin and Paris and many others as well to see this war somehow fizzle out, to see some sort of negotiated solution. There's a general recognition, I think, everywhere, including in Kyiv and Moscow, that there's going to be a negotiated solution here. The question is on what terms and how this is to be achieved. The problem that we have in our discourse in Europe at the moment is that we deal in these generalities. We say, Putin must be defeated, which everybody agrees to. Of course, we all want to have Putin defeated. This is an excellent idea. But the problem is that we don't know what this actually means. Does it mean that Russian aggression is stopped, i.e. there is a ceasefire in situ? If the Russians fail to take over all of Ukraine, is that a defeat for Putin? I guess you could interpret it, though, but in those terms, although perhaps not many people would. Or you could say, Putin could be pushed back to the lines of February 23rd. I mean, that is a huge defeat and humiliation for Russia. And I would say, recently Henry Kissinger talked about this return to the status quo ante. This is what he meant. Yeah, pushing the Russians back to the lines of February 23rd would constitute a defeat. And I think many in Berlin and Paris will probably say at this point, that's accepted. That's an acceptable a point for a negotiated settlement of this conflict. Whether Kyiv will agree is another matter. I mean, fundamentally, this is a war that is being waged by Russia against Ukraine, and the Ukrainians must agree which is the exit point for them. But, 23rd of February is certainly one possibility. Is it perhaps liberating the so-called DNR and LNR and pushing the Russians out of Crimea? Well, a lot of people in Ukraine think that this should be the end goal of this campaign. But A, is it achievable? Not clear at all that this is actually realizable at all, especially given in mind the dangers of possible dangers of escalation. I think a lot of people in Europe will worry about this, continue justly to worry about the Russians resorting to weapons of mass destruction. And also, what would this kind of war look like? How long would it drag? And what would be the role of Western Europe in all of this in supporting, for example, Kyiv's 100% agenda of, let's say, liberating Crimea or DNR and LNR? So you can see how defeating Putin can have so many different aspects, so many different scenarios where I think, you know, Berlin and Paris will have to, at each, you know, with regard to all of those scenarios, they will have to figure out what is in their interest. And so I can see how they're, you know, to come back to your question, I can see how they can decide that it is in their interest to, for example, support, you know, support a status quo ante. Will they, you know, what will it mean? I guess we'll see. But it's just too early at this point because contingencies on the ground change from day to day.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sergei. And if you, dear listeners, would like to find out more about Sergei's research and views on Russian history and politics, please take a look at his excellent books, articles, and interviews. Many of the latter can be found online. He's also very active on Twitter. It's a brilliant one to follow. I can highly recommend it.
Sergei, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for the second episode of our new mini-series, The New Germany. And stay tuned for the next episode about the ever-present problem of Germany's need for energy. Will it ever be able to source enough to feed its rapacious economy without shackling itself to dictatorships around the world?
You can find this and all other episodes of the Körber Stiftung's History and Politics podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or pretty much any other app or website where podcasts are available. If you'd like to find out more about the foundation or Germany's politics and history, visit the Körber Stiftung's website, which I am not going to spell out for you again because Katja gets sad every time an umlaut dies.
Quite right, Oliver. Here's an extra one. Besides, we still have Google in all the countries where this podcast is likely to be available, so our listeners can easily find the Körber Stiftung's website without bowing to the internet's diktat of umlaut erasure.
I think you mean Gurgle, don't you, Katja? But before you get even more upset, let's end this episode in an umlaut fest. So I'll say, auf Wiederhören und tschüss. Dear listeners, it's been lovely to have you with us again.